For us to understand where we are today, where we're going to be in the future, we need to understand our past, ancient past. And in a moment, Laird Scranton is back with me. We're going to be talking about some incredible stories of ancient history. And get ready for that, because some of it will just knock you right out of bed. If you're in bed, we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Laird Scranton back with us. Laird, of course, author of a series of great books and other writings on ancient cosmology, language. Now, these include articles published in the University of Chicago's Anthropology News Academic Journal, Temple University's Encyclopedia of African Religion, and the Encyclopedia Britannica, featured in John Anthony West's Magical Egypt documentary series, our friend Carmen Bolter's documentary, The Pyramid Code, as well. And we're going to be talking about some ancient stories that are just amazing. Laird, welcome back. It's good to have you.
Hey, George. Thank you very much for having me back. Last I recall, my wife and Risa and I had the pleasure of sharing a bottle of wine with you over a table at the Paradigm Symposium.
That's right.
Minneapolis.
I had a great time there. I lived in Minneapolis for a year back in 78, and it's a great city. Is a great city.
It really strikes me as a very nice place. I've only spent a little time there, but I'd like to spend more.
Cold. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
When it gets cold. What have you been doing over the last few years? We haven't seen you.
Oh, really? I've been really busy. My seventh book right now is at the publisher. It's about Scarabray in northern Scotland.
Ooh.
I'll be filming a documentary, some segments of a documentary series with James Swagger this summer.
Oh, really? Let us know when that's done. I'd like to get you back for that.
Okay, that's good. That's going to be called Megalithic Odyssey.
These 3.5 year gaps are way too long for us.
Oh, well, they fly by, you know.
Yeah, they sure are. Let's talk, because you're on with me for a couple hours, talk about a couple things. One, of course, is Immanuel Velikovsky.
Immanuel Velikovsky.
Tell us about him.
Well, he's a really interesting fellow, and he's not really a household name anymore,
no.
But he was for a long time. This guy was a Russian-born psychiatrist. He was trained by Willem Steckel, who was one of the famous students of Sigmund Freud. He edited an academic journal in Berlin for a number of years, and the science and math articles were edited by his close friend Albert Einstein. The two of them helped found the Hebrew University in Israel, and they later on became colleagues at Princeton University. So he's a very odd, interesting guy. He was a historian also, and he had brought his family in the 1940s to New York City to research a sort of psychological historical book he was writing called Oedipus and Akhenaten.
Hmm.
And while he was doing that research, he came across an ancient Egyptian papyrus that seemed to be describing the same effects as are described in the book of Exodus in the Old Testament, talking about ancient Egypt and all of the plagues that descended on Egypt. And so since he had the resources of Columbia University Library at his disposal, he cross-checked to other cultures. He said, look, the effects that we're talking about here are so extreme that these should have been seen globally, not just in
Egypt. That's right. That's right.
And so he compared writings of other cultures around the same period of time and realized they were all describing the same thing at the same period.
Was it a celestial event that they were talking about, Laird?
Well, following the text he was looking at, he realized that the cultures assigned the upset to comets, and they all gave a variety of different names to those comets. But later on down the line, as you followed that name through, oddly, these cultures all assigned the same name to the planet Venus eventually.
Ah.
And so Velikovsky formulated a theory that Venus was not billions of years old, but actually was a recent addition to our solar system, and that it had started out its life as a brilliant comet that the ancient cultures didn't even recognize it as being a planet, and that it had made a close approach to the Earth and caused these effects.
Would it have been a huge comet?
It would have been a brilliant comet, so bright that it could be seen moving across the sky during the daytime. And so these ancient cultures, rather than thinking it was a planet, thought it was something more like the sun or the moon.
And how did it get captured in our solar system?
The way the myths go, people might be familiar with an ancient Greek myth, the myth where Pallas Athena is ejected from the head of Zeus. And Pallas Athena, Velikovsky associates with the planet Venus. In the Greek myth, what happens is there's a prophecy that a goddess named Metis was going to have a child who would be even greater than Zeus. And so to prevent that from happening, Zeus swallows Metis, and then Pallas Athena is ejected from his head. And Velikovsky says that what that's describing is a huge impact, a planet 10 times the size of the Earth smashed into Jupiter, according to Velikovsky, and caused Venus to be ejected from Jupiter.
Ah, okay. That's possible. Now, they're just talking about Earth being involved in a collision. Ironically, Zachariah Sitchin in his Earth Chronicles books talked about that a long time ago.
Yes, and actually that's one of the official theories for how the moon might have formed is that something smashed into the Earth and knocked off a piece that became the moon.
So in 1950, this guy named Velikovsky writes a book called Worlds in Collision.
Right.
And academia went nuts. How come?
They went bonkers. I think they felt threatened. I think they felt that Velikovsky was trying to revitalize the old-time religion, you know? And a lot of the scientists had spent a long time trying to suppress the influence of religion. And so Velikovsky wrote this book, Worlds in Collision, which became a huge runaway bestseller. And the reaction of the astronomers, leading astronomers from Harvard University, was to organize a boycott of the textbook division of the publisher of the book, trying to arm twist them into not publishing the book. And it was a pretty effective boycott, but a very unusual one. There never had really been anything like that, and there hasn't been anything like it since. And the way that the publisher, Macmillan and Company, dealt with it was they took the highly unusual step of transferring their rights to a best-selling book to one of their competitors who didn't have a textbook to
make. Jeez. So Velikovsky's theory then was that several thousand years ago, Venus is ejected from Jupiter? Or how far back?
Right. Well, there isn't a definite timeline. We first track it. Writing appears around 3000 BC. And so the first references to Venus are sometime after that. And they're in many cultures around the planet. It's always expressed in using words and images that were normally reserved for comets. Which seems odd.
Now, when he says it was ejected from Jupiter, to me, it's like a chunk of Jupiter fell off. But what actually happened, do you think?
Well, there was a recent study done by a Chinese astronomer trying to explain why the core of Venus Jupiter is intensely hotter than it should be and half the size that it should be, according to theories.
And the rest of the planet is gas, right?
It is. Actually, it's considered to be a pristine sample of what surrounded the sun, the cloud that the other planets are said to have formed from. And so, according to this Chinese astronomer, he ran a bunch of computerized scenarios, and the one he liked the best, the one that fit the facts best, involved a planet 10 times the size of the Earth smashing into Jupiter, sinking to its core and vaporizing the core, and creating an event that had enough explosive power to accomplish what Velikovsky said happened.
This ejection of Venus, was it instantaneous or did it take years?
No, I think it was instantaneous. Over the course of a day, this planet sank to the core of the planet and vaporized it, and shortly after that, things would have been ejected.
All right, so Venus was not an incoming comet. It was part of a larger object.
Right, it was the result of an impact with a larger object.
Okay, all right. And it spits out Venus, as mythology talks about. What happens to Venus? Where is it at this point?
Okay, now Venus, because it is ejected from Jupiter, which is in the same plane of orbit as...
I love this stuff, by the way.
...the other planets, Venus is now sort of a rogue body roaming the solar system. The path that it's in, because it's in the same plane as the other planets, there's a very, very high likelihood that it would eventually make a close approach to or an impact on planets that were orbiting the sun.
We were lucky. I'm sure it played havoc with us, but we were lucky it didn't hit us again.
We were very lucky. Now, according to Velikovsky, now there are a couple of differences I have with his scenario. According to his scenario, Venus first makes a close approach to the Earth around 1500 BC, and the influences of it coming so close to us caused all sorts of things to happen. It caused volcanoes to erupt and earthquakes to happen, and there are lots of different effects we can see on the Earth at that time that geologists can't explain.
Does it hit Mars?
According to Velikovsky, it hit Mars after it made the close approach to the Earth, but based on what I can see, it hit Mars first. And there actually also have been studies, Caltech did a study to explain the damage we see in the crust of Mars, and their best explanation is it was hit by a planet-sized body.
Had Mars already lost its atmosphere and whatever else it had?
My guess is it lost it because of that impact.
Wow. Oceans, whatever life might have been there, who knows what.
Right. And so it's hard to say what had been there before. Now, in the estimation of the Caltech people who did the study, this is something that happened millions of years ago. But I followed up on that and actually got a hold of one of the researchers and asked the question. I said, what is it that makes you say it happened billions of years ago? And the response I got was, well, everyone knows that there haven't been planet-sized bodies roaming the solar system since that time.
So once Venus, you know, smashes into Mars, bounces around the solar system, what happens to its bright comet tail, and then how does it get into the orbit it's in now?
Okay, by my estimation, what happens is it does make a close approach to the Earth around 1500 BC, and after that, it's really an effect of the comet's tail that its orbit circularizes. And some of the evidence we have that can demonstrate that might have happened, first of all, Venus actually has a remnant comet's tail. There were probes sent recently out to Venus. There's something the European Space Agency sent called Venus Express that was trying to explain why every time they would go around Venus and do a count with instruments of how many ions they could count in the atmosphere, they were losing ions. They couldn't figure out where the ions were going. And at first they thought they were blowing around the back side of the planet, but then they realized they were not only were they blowing around the back side, they were also being ejected off the back like a comet's tail. And this tail actually behaves just like a comet's tail. It gets stronger as Venus approaches the sun, and it always points away from the sun like a comet's tail does. Now, when Venus makes its closest approach to the Earth, a couple of odd things happen. First of all, it always shows the same face to the Earth, just like the moon does, and that could be an indication that the two bodies had come in contact
right.
with each other. And this little remnant tail extends off into space millions of miles and points directly at the Earth, which also suggests that maybe there was contact between the two.
Why, Laird, did astronomers and scientists become so vehemently opposed to Velikovsky? I mean, so you don't agree with his theory, so what? But they attacked this guy.
They really did. He was a real threat to them for a number of reasons. Another reason was that he took the unusual approach of a cross-disciplinary type study. Astronomers, you know, Velikovsky had the nerve to present an astronomic theory, but he was supporting it with what the astronomers saw as fairy tales. You know, this was information that comes out of myths. And astronomers are not prepared to defend an astronomic theory based on ancient mythology. So that was one reason. The crossing of boundaries of disciplines made it very hard for the scientists to respond.
Even Carl Sagan was opposed to him.
Yeah, Carl Sagan was a very vocal critic of Velikovsky, and threw up a number of different obstacles to, or potential obstacles to Velikovsky's theory, including he had said that if this sort of thing had actually happened, the event at Jupiter would have vaporized parts of the planet and left them very hot. And at that time, they didn't realize that that was actually true about the planet.
Now, I would think that today, modern science could either refute what Velikovsky has said or agree with him. Where does it stand?
Well, that was one of the things I was hoping to accomplish with the book, is I thought 60 years after Velikovsky wrote, or more, you know, it would seem that we had accumulated enough science to be able to put this thing to rest one way or the other, tip the controversy either in favor or against Velikovsky. And there are all sorts of sources that we have now that Velikovsky didn't have access to, NASA articles on NASA's websites, and information that's been returned from space probes. There's the Mars Express probe and the Venus Express probe, and there have been all sorts of studies done of comets. We've actually landed probes on comets and taken samples. And so there's lots of information we have that Velikovsky didn't have. So I was trying to favor those kinds of sources, you know, groups that had no axe to grind in terms of in favor of or against Velikovsky.
Well, with Laird Scranton, the book we're talking about right now is called The Velikovsky Heresies. And where do you get the book, by the way, Laird?
The book is published by Inner Traditions, so you can get it at www.innertraditions.com. But it's also available at all the usual outlets. You can get it through Amazon.com. Oftentimes, I find it on the shelf in Barnes & Noble bookstores and places like that. It can be ordered through any bookstore.
If Velikovsky's correct, what have we learned from this theory? Because can this happen again? Can another object either hit another planet coming into the solar system and create this havoc?
Well, oddly, Velikovsky's scenario for how Venus formed has now been adopted, without ever mentioning his name, by the astronomers who study exosolar systems.
Aha.
That their official theory now is that the gas giants form in the first 10 million years, and then the rocky planets form in the next 10 million years, largely as the result of collisions. So they've pretty much endorsed Velikovsky's scenario without ever saying so.
If Velikovsky were alive today, would he be happy?
He'd be very happy because every few months there's some new fact that turns up that is completely in line with what he says, although when the astronomers announce it, they very frequently announce it hand-in-hand with a second theory whose net effect is to distance the find from Velikovsky. For example, Velikovsky had said, when we get to Venus, we're going to discover that it's very hot and that it has a pristine surface because it's a new planet. When the probes got there and discovered that, it was a pristine planet. The astronomers announced that the reason it was pristine was because global forces we don't understand have clearly resurfaced it in the last million years.
That's fantastic. Okay, stick with us, Laird. We're going to come back in a moment to talk about your other book called Point of Origin. We're going to talk about Göbekli Tepe and the spiritual matrix for the world's cosmologies. Fascinating. Ancient material is just fantastic. Welcome back with Laird Scranton. We're talking about this work called now Point of Origin. And Laird, why is there such incredible interest in Göbekli Tepe in southeastern Turkey?
Well, I think the first reason has to do with a controversy about the Sphinx. I'm sure you have spoken with John Anthony West,
yes,
a friend of mine, and Robert Schock,
yep,
the geologist.
Good people.
Back in the 1980s, they presented a theory based on rainwater weathering of the limestone of the Sphinx,
mm-hmm,
that indicated that the Sphinx must be much older than is traditionally stated. There wasn't enough rainwater in Egypt at 2400 BC to weather it the way that it is.
That's right.
So the first interest in Göbekli Tepe is it presents evidence of megalithic construction, stone construction, thousands of years earlier than the Sphinx. So as a matter of fact, it's so old, the site is so old. This is a site in southeastern Turkey. It was part of the Fertile Crescent back in ancient times. The site is so old that it actually precedes the earliest evidence we have of the tools required to build it.
Jeez.
It's a really old site.
So what does that tell you?
Well, it means that somebody, in a period of time when traditionally it's thought there were only hunter-gatherers in that area, somebody was quarrying stone, moving at a distance, creating stone circles with pillars and intricate carvings of animals on the pillars. Very interesting site. They're not even sure what it was used for. They know that people didn't live there because they don't find any of the usual refuse that a city would produce. They haven't found enough human bones for it to have been a burial site. They know it wasn't a fortification, a military fortification. It's not located in a strategic way that way. So they're not sure what it was used for.
Now, it's got circles of standing pillars. It's got incredible carved images of animals. How big, Laird, are some of the stone blocks?
The stone blocks are multi-ton. Some of the biggest ones are multi-ton stone blocks. So they know that whoever put this thing together was pretty capable.
Yeah.
The mystery is you have multiple series of stone circles that they're not sure why that happens. As you move up this hillside or down the hillside, you have multiple incarnations of what looks like essentially the same structure.
What does it look like to you? I mean, what do you think its purpose was?
Well, my main field of study is called comparative cosmology.
Okay.
I basically compare the myths and symbols and words and deities of ancient religions, trying to learn more about them. And when you get back down to the bottom of traditions like Buddhism and in ancient Egypt and in Africa and places like that, one of the themes you hear again and again is that civilizing skills were instructed to humanity in ancient times. Now, at Göbekli Tepe, the site is located in a spot that is right next to where they find the first cultivated grains, the first domesticated animals, the first incarnation, as I said, of stoneworking. There are a lot of firsts that happen right in that area, so that could very well have been a site where civilizing skills were instructed.
Yeah, how big is that area?
The area itself, the Fertile Crescent, covers the area of southeast Turkey and western Iran. It's a pretty big region. We're not 100% sure what it was like back at 10,000 BC, but it's certainly the cradle of civilization as far as DNA studies go and studies of the spread of these civilizing skills. You can see by those kinds of studies that things started in that region.
Could it have been some kind of landing area for extraterrestrial craft?
Well, I don't have any cultures that actually say that, and my problem from my perspective of my studies is that in order to keep me on track with interpretations I make, one of my requirements is that at least one of the cultures I'm studying has to make a claim before I try to endorse it. So from their perspective, in Buddhism, when you get down to the bottom, they flatly say that this instruction came from a non-human source. The Dogon also say, this is an African tribe that I study from western, northwest Africa, they say that they got their most sacred symbols from a non-human source, but they add that it was also a non-material source in sort of a complicated way. The Dogon say that there was a problem that the people who taught them were concerned about medical effects on us from being around them. And their solution to that was they took 8 tribe members and sequestered them someplace at a distance from where the tribe was, instructed those 8, and then sent them back to teach everybody else. And that's sort of a theme we see all over the world of, you know, in China and other places, the Central and South America, all sorts of places, the story of the 8 mythical ancestors who come and teach civilizing skills.
Exactly. What is it about Göbekli Tepe that fascinates you?
First of all, that it is so old. Also, the elements, the symbolic elements we see there are things that had importance 7,000 years later at 3,000 BC. You know, the animals we see pictured on these stones are very oftentimes animals that were adopted as icons by the first kings or by deities of cultures like ancient Egypt. As a matter of fact, the names of all of the animals that are pictured on these pillars are pronounced like words of cosmology, which means creation. It looks as if these animals were meant to represent stages of creation.
Fascinating. Now, what other regions of this planet, Laird, fascinate you, interest you, that you've done some work on?
At 10,000 BC, I see influences happening in the Fertile Crescent area that seem to be at least regional, if not global.
10,000 BC.
10,000 BC. We see architectural traditions at Göbekli Tepe that are also reflected all over the world. You see them at, you know, in Peru in early times. You see them in Egypt. You see them in other places around the world. So the 10,000 BC seems to be the earliest influence that we can trace. The Ice Age, which ended just before that, sort of serves as a block to evidence, so it's hard to trace things back farther than that. But the second set of influences I see seem to come from the area of northern Scotland around 4,000, between 4,000 and 3,200 BC.
Northern Scotland, what happened there?
This is actually the subject of an upcoming book, but what you have there is a very accessible, looks like instructional sanctuary, where you have stages of creation carved in stone sequentially. A person could actually follow a life-sized set of these stages of creation enshrined in stone, follow a road that led to a little village called Scarabray. And those influences are tricky to trace. The researchers have no idea where they came from. These are not Scandinavian influences. The names aren't Scandinavian. The pottery isn't Scandinavian. The style of construction isn't Scandinavian, so they're not sure where they came from.
Laird, what's the big message that comes from places like Göbekli Tepe in terms of what it means to us as people who are, you know, going to go through some pretty darn rough times ahead? What does the ancient works tell us?
What it says to me is that we had help. We had sort of a foot up from somebody who was very capable in ancient times. And that's not to diminish us or our capabilities or anything else, but it looks like somebody who had our best interests at heart helped us recover after the Ice Age in the same way that FEMA should help a group recover after a hurricane, or the Peace Corps might go into a country after a disaster. It looks like somebody tried to do that for us.
Are you familiar with the work of Michael Cremo?
Yes, I am. Actually, Michael Cremo is a friend of mine. I've
spoken
at conferences with him. He wrote a very important book called Forbidden Archaeology.
Yes.
A 700-page book filled with anomalies that have been discovered by archaeologists.
Michael believes that mankind is much older than what the scientists are telling us today. I mean, much older, maybe tens of millions of years older. What do you think of his theories?
Well, I think he's done very careful research, and I think there's a lot to what he says. But from my perspective, it's hard to trace things back even before 3000 BC when writing appears. But there are ways of doing that back as far as 10,000 BC. But as soon as you bump up against the Ice Age, the Ice Age effectively sort of wiped evidence clean. It's hard to tell what happened. We don't have written text to rely on. All we really have are archaeological finds and myths and stories to work from.
Laird, biblically speaking, does the Bible coincide with any of these stories that you've written about?
Sure. I mean, the book of Enoch talks about a similar kind of event where somebody claims to have been taken away to an advanced site and taught things and then brought back. So it definitely falls in line. There are comparisons that can be made symbolically to times of Christianity and so forth. A lot of the African words that I study are also Egyptian words, but they're also ancient Hebrew words. So there are commonalities at 3000 BC. The Dogon god Amma, his name also means, he represents a hidden god, but his name also means to grasp or to hold firm or to establish. The same is true in Egypt with Amen. And when you go to the Hebrew word Amen, it comes from a Hebrew word that means to establish. So you have those kinds of commonalities that go across cultures that allow us to trace things back and forth. And there's no reason to think that the Judaic things that happened didn't trace forward into Christianity.
How advanced do you think technology might have been during these time periods?
Somebody in ancient times understood deep science and not in a theoretic way. One of the first books that I wrote, called The Science of the Dogon, is it came out of a declaration by the Dogon priests that their tradition describes how matter forms, and they give very careful descriptions of the stages of matter. And I noticed they had the definition of an atom right, and the definition of protons, electrons, and neutrons right, and they had a drawing to go with that that looks just like an electron orbit. And so that book basically lays out side-by-side comparisons of what the Dogons say and how they diagram it with what people like Brian Greene and Stephen Hawking say and how they diagram it. And it's all the right stuff, from waves all the way up to the atom.
Have you ever come across any information that would lead you to believe that they might have had high technology in terms of tools, flying machines, things like that?
Well, anybody who understood matter to that level, and they also, there's evidence, I can demonstrate that they understood things about how the universe forms and so forth. They carry their discussions beyond what modern astrophysicists talk about. The Dogon talk about what preceded the Big Bang, and they talk about how it is that a wave turns into a particle. These are things that astrophysicists are not typically talking about. Whoever understood that stuff would, that implies that they had capabilities that are equal at least to what we have right now.
What region, what area would you say to you is the most fascinating? Would it be the pyramids, the Sphinx, Göbekli Tepe, Stonehenge? What would it be?
Well, right now my focus is on sort of foundational concepts that make this stuff work. This comes out of archaic philosophies, and in the view of those philosophies, matter is a byproduct of the influences of two universes, that our universe has a non-material twin, and that when the energies of those two universes come together in the context of an act of perception, material creation is the byproduct. That's an automatic result. And so that's an area that fascinates me, because it gets down into foundational things that our science right now doesn't talk about.
You're familiar, of course, with the work of Eric von Däniken as well.
Right, absolutely. He's the grand old man of this whole field.
Exactly. What do you think of those Nazca lines in Peru?
Well, I've heard a number of different theories about what they were for and why they're there. There's a middle school teacher from Poughkeepsie, New York, who studies water. He's a dowser, and he's able to go into villages in places like Peru and find water where, you know, skilled teams that come in from Israel and places like that have failed to find water. So this guy feels that the Nazca lines were drawn there to indicate to some capable group where the water was.
Amazing work. How many people are involved in the studies of ancient technologies like this?
Oh, there are a lot, many, many. I mean, you know, Christopher Dunn is a good example of somebody who's trying to find technological basis for the pyramid shapes, the building of the pyramids. And we have pyramids all along a single line that goes around the planet.
They're everywhere.
Yeah, it's a system. So I can't say with certainty what they were used for, but for someone to go to that much work to build a single pyramid, that had to have had a productive purpose.
Göbekli Tepe, might they have lived there too?
Yes. Okay, one of the factors that's involved here is that if there was a group that was trying to teach us, they would have needed a safe haven from us. And actually, in some of the later traditions that this tracks forward to, there may have also been reasons why we needed to be kept distance from some of them. Some of them may have not been 100% friendly to us. So I think that the high mountaintop sanctuaries that characterize these very archaic traditions are a way of protecting the teachers.
Huh, interesting possibilities there. If you could find out one thing about what you've been working on over all these years to get an answer to that big question you're probably seeking, what would that be?
I think the ultimate question at the bottom of it is who it is that was doing these things. There are lots of indicators that are suggestive, but to be able to get down to...
And what happened to them?
Well, yeah, and I know for certain from what I see that someone had our best interests at heart. Someone bent over backwards to do the right thing for us. The Dogon actually questioned their teachers. They said, "Are you God?" And the teacher said, "Well, no, we're not God, but if you want to, if it helps you be more comfortable, you can think of us as agents of God." Somebody, every time they had the opportunity to assert power over us, chose not to. And every time they had the opportunity to tell us a fib, they chose not to. Somebody bent over backwards to do the right thing for us.
But where'd they go? They're gone. Egypt. I mean, all this lost information and knowledge, it's gone. What happened?
Well, this may have to do with, I mean, there are concepts in Buddhism of a yuga cycle, that there are changes in humanity's ability to perceive certain things that are cyclical, and that over time we have an ascending capability, and then after a period of time, sort of like seasons, our abilities get less and less, and we've just passed the point where our abilities to perceive things beyond the material world were at their worst. We're now improving again, supposedly. And you can sort of see that in the world. There's a lot of activity right now that's sort of spiritually related or at the edge of science related, the telepathy and remote viewing and things like that going on. There's a big increase in that right now.
It's amazing work. Stay with us, Laird. We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM, and we are going to take phone calls. It's an amazing subject. Velikovsky, of course, talking about Venus, captured comet, and then, of course, the work out there at Göbekli Tepe and other ancient sites.